This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will often select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 119th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, we're looking at Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 2 from Marvel Comics, of course. Cover dated November 1994. This issue features full-length reprints of Daredevil 160, Fantastic Four 233, The Incredible Hulk 315, and Iron Man 116. For coverage of episode number 1 of the magazine, which featured the prior issue of all of those titles, refer to Quarterbin episode 109. The reviews and discussions of each of these four full-length issues will, of course, be slightly shorter than the traditional full-length reviews and discussions that issues usually get on the show. The goal is for this not to be four times as long as the average episode. But first, because it's already going to be a long show anyway, why not catch up on some feedback? Last episode, I talked about Free Comic Book Day and asked for listeners to share FCBD experiences. Dr. Ange said that it was a great episode. Thank you. My store only allows two freebies, so I grabbed DC Superhero Girls and The Only Living Boy. I didn't have time to hit multiple stores. I gave him a frowny face in reply on only getting two books, but he replied that it was okay because those two were the ones he really wanted most. That's one of the things I like about Free Comic Book Day. It's having that list of what you want, you know, the priority, the order, your preference of the books, and hopefully crossing them off as the day goes by. Glad that you did get your top two choices there, Doc. And this, from Luke Giaconetti of the Earth Destruction Directive podcast. Great show, Alan. This was my first year bringing the kids with me to Free Comic Book Day, and they had a lot of fun picking, reading, and trading comics. Awesome, Luke. And remember, M turned 27 a few weeks after Free Comic Book Day, and the two of us went to the event together. So I wish you many, many, many future comic book events with the kids, Luke, even when they may not count as kids anymore. On that podcast for the post, I used the picture of M and Daredevil as the preview pick, and Clinton Robinson from Coffee and Comics responded to that. I can't get over M and the cool Nightwing hoodie. I know that is definitely one of their best purchases ever. Likes and retweets and shares for that episode came from many of the fine folks we've just mentioned, and also Pat Sampson from the Long Box Crusade, the Irredeemable Shag, Robert Ludwig, Corey Hodson, the Crapbox of the Son of Cthulhu blog, the great Kansan Gregorujo, now from the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, the Comics in the Golden Age show, Al Sedano from Resurrections, the Warlock Thanos podcast, Old School Ross, Sir Iowa's Joe, Chris Willett, and Mr. Dystopia. Thank you for all of that. Very much appreciated. So let's get on to the main event. Marvel Superheroes Magazine, number 2, had an original cover price of $2.95, meaning I got an excellent 91.5% discount on this book. I nabbed issues 1 through 5 of the titles last year from my LCS, World's Greatest Comics, and I'm going to cover those on every 9 episode. The first one was on episode 109, then here at 119, 129, etc. The cover of Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 2 by Frank Miller is mostly black, as is befitting a cover by Frank Miller. In the center of the big box of black is Daredevil and Black Widow, but we see very little of them because of all the black. On the right side of them are three little circles, one for the Thing, one for Iron Man, and one for Hulk. And on the other side of the page, we have short blurbs for each of the stories. This cover is pretty striking, to be honest, although the Thing doesn't look all that great in his profile circle, and that's a bit deceptive anyway, having the Thing there as the FF story, spoilers, stars Johnny Storm, with Ben only in it for a few panels on a few pages. But as far as technicalities go, I guess that one is pretty minor. Back in episode 109, I agonized a bit about the format for these number 9 episodes and settled on the idea of selecting one story in the issue as the lead story, which will get a little bit fuller examination, closer at least to the regular Quarterbin treatment, while the other three will be the backup stories for the episode, not getting quite as much podcast time as the main story. Now, last time it was the Iron Man story that was that lead story, as it was my favorite of the four, and I want to try to do a different lead story each time for these episodes. So I looked at the other three, the FF, the Hulk, and Daredevil, and of those, my favorite was the Hulk story. So we're going to start right there, and we'll do that right after this.
Hi, I'm John Wilson.
And I'm Michael Kaiser.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Make Ours Marvel. You know, here we are in 2018, 10 years into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, can you believe we live in a world where everyone's old Aunt Petunia knows who Iron Man is?
It's crazy, right?
So, to celebrate, we're on our mission to explore the roots of the Marvel Universe.
You know you've thought about it. Some of you may have even done it. And now we're going to do it too.
We're diving back into the long boxes of Marvel's history and podcasting our way through the whole universe.
All of it. Every superhero issue. And, if I can convince Mike, we'll even do Sergeant Fury.
And it's not going to be one issue per episode. That'd take forever.
It's still going to take forever.
But no, we're going to talk about as many comics as we can in an hour.
Yep, an hour and, you know, maybe a little change. Every week, Marvel Comics. So it'd be super cool if you came along for the ride.
Look for us every Friday at MakeOursMarvel.com.
That's MakeOursMarvel.com or on iTunes and all the other usual podcasty places.
And if you want to read along with us and send us your thoughts, we might even read emails.
So until Avengers Infinity War gets a spin-off Warlock and the Infinity Watch TV show,
Make Ours Marvel.
And we're back. And we're looking at The Incredible Hulk 315, originally cover dated January 1986. The story, Freedom, was written and penciled by John Byrne, with Keith Williams on inks. Across the top of the first page, Stan Lee promises a dramatic change in the life of the Incredible Hulk. And I gotta give Stan credit on this one. That's pretty accurate. For this story, and for all the stories that we'll discuss on this episode, both the Marvel Wikia and Comic Book DB were used as jumping-off points for crafting these story synopses. We start with the Hulk wearing a pair of torn overalls, banging on the walls of a specially constructed containment room deep within Bruce Banner's secret lab. Keeping him restrained in the room is Bruce Banner himself. When Banner vows to keep the Hulk contained forever, the Hulk flies into a rage, cursing Banner. Do you hear me, Banner? Let me go! You've ruled my life for too long, Hulk. Well, no more. You're finally caged, finally imprisoned. But Hulk forces his way out of puny Banner's cell, telling puny Banner that he has no life without Hulk. At one point, he looms over the puny scientist, saying that he is free again. Hulk will smash you, Banner. And he tries to smash Banner, but misses, breaking the wall of the cavern and creating an opening to the outside world. Bruce tries to make a run for it, seeing this, as his one chance for escape. If I can squeeze through, get out into the open. But the Hulk, telling him he won't escape that easily, leaps and lands on top of his other half, preparing to literally crush Banner's skull. Hulk tells him that he, Hulk, is not a monster and not a demon that he can run from. Hulk is your own dark thought, your anger, your rage. But just before he can murderize Bruce, Banner suddenly disappears and reappears a fair distance away, and whenever the Hulk tries to get closer to puny Banner, he moves further and further away. Hulk chases. Hulk moves as fast as he can. But Banner is gone, and Hulk cannot think. And then we learn that, surprise, this is all a dream of Bruce Banner, as he undergoes a nutrient bath at the newly reconstructed Gamma base under the supervision of Doc Samson, which is to say, actual university professor Dr. Leonard Samson. The purpose of the bath is, in fact, to separate Banner from the Hulk. This technique was invented by Samson, whose work is being broadcast on live TV by reporter Diane Bellamy. Now, this part has a lot of talking in it, so I don't know if I mentioned this. Doc Samson, university professor, so he likes to hear the sound of his own voice. The process of separation is apparently a success, as an unconscious Bruce Banner is pulled from the tank, while the big green Hulk remains inside in the nutrient bath. Doc Samson explains, which is his go-to move, that the Hulk is now a blank slate without Banner being a part of him, and he contemplates the benefits to psychology from such a thing. The Hulk now represents a fabulous laboratory for the mind. So he has plans of training the Hulk, developing the beast's tabula rasa mind. But then he's interrupted by a bunch of S.H.I.E.L.D. agents led by Clay Quatermain, who are there to secure the facility. Quatermain explains how they are under orders to eliminate the Hulk. Samson is against this idea, but Quatermain wants to make sure that the Hulk never returns no matter what, and his S.H.I.E.L.D. credentials give him the authority to do just that. When Diane, the TV journalist, explains that her feed is going out live and she's going to report about this senseless execution, Clay explains that S.H.I.E.L.D. scrambled her transmission the moment her crew started rolling. In other words, none of what she has reported, none of what Samson has explained, has reached the outside world. The news crew is briefly detained, briefly because Doc Samson lets them out, and explains to them that he intends to rescue the Hulk before he is executed. When S.H.I.E.L.D. begins the process of shipping the big green guy out of Gamma Base, Samson forces his way onto the carrier vehicle. He actually burrows up through the desert floor and gets into the vehicle from below. After removing Hulk from the neuro-neutralizer, Doc takes control of the vehicle only to learn that it is remotely piloted. Which is good, actually. Excellent, excellent. Without additional human lives to worry about, I don't need to be subtle. Freed from the remote control, the vehicle suddenly crashes and bursts into flame. The guys in a nearby S.H.I.E.L.D. helicopter quickly conclude that nobody could have survived that. Except, wait a second, it's him. The Hulk is still alive. Yeah, he's alive and just a little bit angry. He rips off a piece of metal as big as he is from the damaged truck and hurls it at the S.H.I.E.L.D. helicopters. One explodes, and then the other one in response opens fire. See, this is why the Hulk doesn't socialize all that well without Banner giving him, you know, that bit of assistance. Not long after, Doc Samson emerges from the rubble and realizes his mistake in believing that the Hulk alone as a separate, independent entity can be reasoned with. but I can make up for it. I can yet vindicate myself. I can track down the Hulk once again. And this time, I will kill him. In the final page epilogue, a woman enters a hospital and asks about a patient. I was told Bruce Banner had been brought here, but then I heard about the Hulk rampaging. The nurse agrees that this is definitely a confusing situation. Bruce Banner is here all right. Don't ask me how that's possible with the Hulk still on the loose. But I'm afraid he isn't allowed any visitors, Miss. Miss Ross, the woman answers. My name is Betty Ross. The end. There are a number of exciting promises that are, you know, promised at the bottom of this page regarding the action in next issue. But since we'll be covering that issue in just 10 episodes, let's skip those previews for spoiler's sake and just talk about what I thought about this story. Now, here's the thing. I talked about this 10 episodes ago, and that is this. I'm really not a huge fan of the Hulk. Part of that is a matter of my comparative less interest in Marvel than DC, probably. But even with that, looking just at Marvel characters, there are a lot that I'd have to name in terms of favorites, in terms of ones I like. It would be a pretty long list before I got to the Hulk. And I know that the Hulk is the absolute favorite Marvel character of at least one good and faithful friend of the show, of the network. And to that man,
I am Michael Bailey.
I apologize. That said, I did like this story, and that's the rub, I think. Because this isn't a standard Hulk story, at least to my mind. We start with a 7-page action sequence between Hulk and Banner. He does some pounding and smashing. He gets out of captivity and then out of the base altogether. There's some solid Hulking out, some solid Hulk smash. But of course, that was just a dream, so it's kind of a cheat. Then the next 10 pages are basically the Doc Samson show, with him doing actually some pretty cool action stuff. Digging up through the road, grabbing onto the undercarriage, the underside of the vehicle, punching through the floor, setting Hulk free, all of that is actually pretty great. And then Hulk gets one moment taking down the helicopter, but that's the only real, that is, not counting a dream, that's the only real moment of action that he gets in the issue. And that's indicative of my general thoughts on this issue. I like the story, but it was a Hulk-light story. And I don't just mean it was light on the big green guy. It was pretty light on Bruce Banner, too. He is asleep or comatose or in the hospital for the entirety of the story. Except for the dream sequence, he is no factor in the action. As a matter of fact, that's the problem. I think I like this because it was a Hulk-light story. I liked almost all of the other elements that Byrne brings into this. S.H.I.E.L.D., Quatermain, Betty, and especially Professor Leonard Samson. Now, I do understand that this is a dramatic moment for the Hulk, this separation, that that's a big deal. What Byrne is doing here will have ramifications for the character down the road, no doubt. So for that, I can certainly recognize the importance of the issue of this story to the Hulk. Again, it's just that it's not a story that focuses on the action of the Hulk or of Banner. As important as the story is, as much of a hinge point that it is, from here things will never be the same and all of that, the Hulk is not in it a whole lot. Doc Samson is pretty much the star of the issue, and for me, just between us, that works. Not a complaint. First of all, everyone knows we need more university professors as heroes. There are a few, but more are always welcome. And we also need more professors as heroes who have beautiful, full, flowing green locks. Give Leonard Samson credit. The fellow has some awesome hair, and he knows how to dress. He has a sense of style that I wish more of my colleagues in the academic setting would emulate. That's all I'm saying. And certainly, having a strong supporting cast is an important part of having a successful, long-running comic series. But when those side characters are one's favorite parts of the story, that can turn into a problem, and that's largely where I am with the Hulk. Obviously, I see where the concept has potential, the Jekyll and Hyde stuff. That can be mined. There are clear thematic things that can be played with. But maybe I just think the character is limited. I haven't run into a lot of great Hulk stories that do something other than play with the Jekyll and Hyde stuff. I don't know where else you go with the character, with that character trope. I know that there are lots of fans of the character. I envy you for seeing things in the guy that I don't. It's like you say when you break up with someone, it's not you, it's me. I'm the one that doesn't get the Hulk. And maybe that's why Byrne went ahead and performed the Hulkectomy on Banner. Maybe he figures that separating the two characters and can give him that greater potential for storytelling. I don't know that for sure, but in 10 episodes from now, we'll get to the next issue. And then 10 more episodes after that, we'll get to the next one. And I do have to say, I am really looking forward to analyzing those stories, to really dig into what Byrne was doing at this, what I recognize is a very critical juncture for the character. I'm not sure that in all this rambling, I made this one point clear enough, so let me repeat it. I really did like the story. I like the concept of separating Banner and Hulk. I like this cast. I like Doc Samson. And I really dig what Byrne did on the penciling and storytelling side of his role. I don't want to ignore the artistic side of the comic. Things were dynamic, things moved, the action scenes, even if one of them was in a dream, they were all solid. Samson grabbing onto the bottom of that van and punching through the floor, that whole sequence was very well done, very easy to follow, and quite dramatic. So, good John Byrne, good Doc Samson, and not a lot of Hulk. It's a weird combination, but one that, weirdly enough, pretty much worked for me. Well, there are three more stories in this jam-packed, overstuffed magazine of an issue, and we do have to get to those. So after this brief promo for another podcast, which I hear is almost as good as this one, we'll be back to look at stories featuring the Fantastic Four, Daredevil, and Iron Man.
Doom Patrol.
1963.
Doom Patrol debut.
My Greatest Adventure, issue 80. 1964.
My Greatest Adventure renamed Doom Patrol.
Issue 85. 1968.
Doom Patrol destroyed.
Issue 121. 1976.
The new Doom Patrol.
Showcase 94. 1987.
Doom Patrol Volume 2.
Kupperberg Lytle. 1989.
Morrison and Case.
Issue 19. 1993.
Pollack.
Issue 64. 2001.
Doom Patrol Volume 3.
Arcudi Hewitt. 2004.
Doom Patrol Volume 4.
Byrne.
Shush.
2009.
Doom Patrol Volume 5.
Giffen Clark. 2012. 2013. 2014. 2015? 2016?
Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, because we're waiting.
Available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
And we're back with the other three stories in the issue. And we'll cover those in the order in which they appear in the magazine. Which brings us to Fantastic Four 233, originally cover dated August 1981. The story, Mission for a Dead Man, was written, penciled, and inked by John Byrne. Evidently, he was comfortable enough with his inking skill a month after last issue to ditch the anagramic pen name Bjorn Heim. We start on death row, where career criminal David Munson is spending his last day on Earth. The man has finally made peace with his fate and tells Father Albert Vito that he is innocent of the murder that landed him on death row, but that that is the only crime he has ever been innocent of. Munson asks the father to deliver a letter for him to someone he hopes can help clear his name. Vito agrees to deliver the letter personally, and soon Munson meets his final fate in Old Sparky. Later, the father looks at the letter, surprised to find it addressed to the Human Torch. The father tries to find the four in the Baxter building, but security precautions make that difficult. Eventually, Sue takes him up, assuring him that the security scanners within the team's HQ have already deemed him non-threatening. Father Vito is shocked to find the thing trying to hurt the Human Torch after he taped a picture of Christopher Reeve to the thing's mirror with a mocking note that that is what a real hero looks like. Reed intervenes, and the thing goes out, telling them that he'll come back once he cools down. If I cool down. Sue yells at Johnny for causing a scene when they have a guest, a priest, no less. Sue and Reed leave Johnny alone to discuss the father's purpose for his visit. The letter contains the final wishes of Munson, who apologizes for his past treatment of Johnny and asks for his help in clearing his name for the crime he died for the sake of his mother, who is apparently unaware of the entire rest of his criminal career. Johnny recalls George, or Georgie Munson, as one of his chief tormentors back in his early days at Glenville High before he became the Torch. He agrees to look into the case. He looks through the police files, and the evidence against Georgie is strong. He then decides to check out the scene of the crime, although the murder was committed years earlier, but he hopes to find a clue. Arriving at the liquor store, the owner is agreeable about letting Johnny look around up until the hero tries to gain entrance to the back room. The Torch leaves, but returns that night and sees the shop owner in a panic, contacting his boss, a man known as H. Johnny traces that phone number to a warehouse and finds a gang of thugs. Johnny burns away half of the hair from one dude's face to get an address to a nearby penthouse. There, he is surprised to learn that it is owned by the superpowered Magia leader known as Hammerhead. H for Hammerhead. He busts in and confronts Hammerhead, who surprises him with his sudden strength. Realizing that Hammerhead should just be a regular guy, but wasn't harmed when he grabbed Johnny's burning leg, the Torch burns away Hammerhead's outer clothing and reveals a strength-enhancing exosuit. Hammerhead then surprises Johnny by leaping out the side of the building, and somehow, he just vanishes. The police arrives, the detective arrives, and tells Johnny he ought to get accommodation. Johnny goes through some files on the kingpin that Daredevil just brought in, and he finds evidence that clears Munson. And in the epilogue, he meets Munson's mother at her son's grave and explains that Georgie was framed by the liquor store owner. The mom admits that she knew that her son was no good the whole time. The mom tells Johnny that he, Johnny, is the kind of boy a mother can be proud of, leaving the Torch to reflect on the entire experience. The end. First, I admit that that was a long synopsis, longer than I anticipated. But there is a mystery element to this plot, and so the plotting of that is the key aspect to the story. So I had to include a fair amount of that. That might be the strength of the story, as a matter of fact, the plotting. Nice for John Byrne to stretch himself a bit, maybe tell a different genre of story than he usually does. More of a police procedural or mystery type story. Now, one major problem with this that I had, I really wanted the priest to be Father Lantum from the Daredevil TV show. But I guess New York City actually has more than one Catholic priest in it. Who knew? But like I said earlier in the episode, in discussing the cover, that this is not an FF story, it's a Human Torch story. Let me put it this way. The Hulk was in that Hulk story I just talked about more than Reed, Ben, and Sue were in this story. They are nowhere to be seen, in fact, for the last 15 pages of this. Now, of course, that makes it tricky because, let's be honest, the best FF stories feature Dr. Doom, obviously. Well, I mean, the best comic book stories feature Dr. Doom. That's actually a proven scientific fact. There have been scores of papers presented at conferences all across Latveria, published by the University of Doomstadt Press, a very well-respected academic outlet within the country, that without qualification definitely prove that Doom's presence in a story increases the quality by a minimum of 52%. So this story has the big disadvantage of having no Doom. But that is offset tremendously by the distinct lack of Reed, because it is hard to overstate how much Reed's presence hurts an FF story. But then that is balanced out by the lack of Miss Susan Storm, the unsung hero of the team. I mean, the most powerful, the wisest, the sweetest, the kindest member of the team.
She is hot.
Yes, Shag, there is that too. So it's a little hard to judge the story, lacking so many of its usual components. But overall, I thought this worked pretty well, actually, as a Human Torch story. Maybe not quite as well as an FF story. Which brings us to Daredevil 160, originally cover dated September 1979. In the Hands of Bullseye, was written by Roger McKenzie and drawn and inked by a little artistic team I like to call Frank Miller and Klaus Janson. We start in Black Widow's posh New York apartment, where she needs to be alone to let her hair down and try to forget that sooner or later, the Black Widow brings death to everyone she touches. But inside, she is surprised to be greeted by Bullseye. A lovely night for a murder, isn't it? They fight for a few pages, and Bullseye is impressed. You're a resourceful widow, I'll give you that. But there's no one alive as resourceful as Bullseye. He does eventually subdue her, and very kindly explains his thinking to her, and to us. You will be the instrument of Daredevil's death. When he learns that I have you, he will come for me. And that is when I will kill you both. By mid-morning of the following day, the rain has become a steady downpour, a perfect setting for the funeral of Maxwell Glenn, at which Matt tries to comfort the dead man's daughter, Heather Glenn. Their conversation doesn't go well, and by not well, I mean it ends with her slapping him and storming off. Not the first time a relationship of Matt's has ended thusly. Back at his place, Matt pours himself a drink and feels sorry about himself. He gets so blamed lonely sometimes and needs someone to talk to, someone like Natasha. But he hasn't seen her in several days. So like any normal lonely guy does, he puts on a red bodysuit, swings across the city, and enters her apartment through an open window. He calls out her name, but she does not answer. He uses radar sense and super-sensitive fingers to figure out that she's been taken. At the Daily Bugle, Daredevil and Ben Urich talk about Bullseye. Urich says that according to his sources, Bullseye was a modern prisoner until he escaped 4 days ago. He doesn't get much other help and heads over to Josie's, saying that he'll scour every underworld dive in this city until he finds Bullseye. And he promptly gets into a bar brawl. He wants info about Bullseye and the stoolies there don't want to talk. Except for when some cash starts getting flashed around, and then a few guns get pulled. Daredevil and his buddy Turk get a little bit of info. But mostly there's just a lot of brawling. Most of these thugs have been on the wrong side of fights with DD, and see this as a chance at revenge, a chance to get in some good licks on the guy. And of course, it's not a brawl with Josie's until someone gets thrown through the front glass window. And then on the last half of the final page, right after someone has gotten thrown through the front glass window, in a section of the story titled, very oddly, Prologue, he tells Turk he wants him to find Bullseye. And when you do, tell him Daredevil is coming. Next, for the life of the widow, Daredevil stalks an island of death. The end. I read this a couple days ago, and I'm still trying to figure out that last half page and the mysterious word prologue. I would like to think that this was a clever, literary thing, as if this is actually the start of the next issue. This may be a brilliant way to connect this issue to the next one, some type of metatextual thing, using the comics form in a brand new way. Except that I've been reading comics a long time, and in the last decade or so, I've read books and heard interviews on podcasts and other places with comic book professionals, writers, and editors and all that. And by the principle of Occam's razor, it seems to me the simplest conclusion is often the correct conclusion. And thus, after pondering this, I now believe that the word prologue on the last page is a mistake. I'm guessing that the writer made this mistake, prologue versus epilogue, just not thinking, using the wrong word. We've all done this before. And the letterer lettered what was in the script, and the editor, the assistant editor, well, it just got by them. And let me veer off just for a second, because the job of editor, that doesn't mean the job duties are not just what we think they are. In everyday life, we hear the word editor, and we assume that means line editor, going over the product before it heads out to the printer and catching every mistake. We think that's the primary job. But in the comics biz, the editor and the assistant editor do a lot more than just read drafts of stories. They are connectors in the comic world. That's the way that I've heard it phrased. They're the go-betweens between the scripter, the penciler, the inker, the colorist, the letterer. Their job is really to make the trains run on time, which means to get the issue out by its deadline. So a lot of the work they do is people skills, staying in contact with all the people on the creative team that it's taking to put the book together, and just getting the pages from one to the other. And actually line editing, quote-unquote, you know, fixing mistakes, is actually not a major part of their job. All of that is not to excuse the obvious error of using the exact opposite word, prologue, when you certainly mean epilogue. I'm just saying that it's not 100% clear that that's Mary Jo Duffy's or Al Milgram's fault here. These things happen in comics, we know that. Too often, but they do happen. Okay. On to the story itself. And I got to say, I came very close to making this one the feature story. It's really strong, moody, emotional, intense, dramatic, exciting. There's even a little bit of humor or lightness where needed. I'm certainly hoping that the trajectory for Daredevil continues in this direction, because if that's the case, the next couple of issues of this might be really good. I want to mention one little thing. It's just a cool detail, and which I also found kind of funny. But during that big brawl at Josie's, there's a boxing match going on the TV, and the TV commentary matches the actions in the bar brawl. Like, and there's the bell. What a struggle. The champ's really in trouble now. What a punch. There's total mayhem in the ring. And when you can lay in those little details like that, it just really adds to the overall depth of the storytelling, I think. And even though Foggy is not there much, he does get a line. He's at the funeral. But most of the rest of the supporting cast is in this issue. And that just rounds out the story, which is quite personal. It's quite small. But you do get touches of this bigger world for Matt. And the art was quite good. There's a youthful energy here, and the action scenes are well laid out and well choreographed. The radar sense is cool. The Billy Club does wonders. I really like all that stuff. It's a bit modern. It's a bit experimental for 1979, but still well within comic book standards. There's nothing crazy here, but just good, solid work. I think these guys individually, Frank Miller and Klaus Janson, might have a bright future in comics ahead of them. It wouldn't surprise me, as a matter of fact, if they teamed up together every now and then. But we'll just have to wait and see. And rounding out our issue, our episode, is The Invincible Iron Man 116, a book originally cover dated November 1978, making it the earliest or oldest story in the magazine. That story, Anguish, Once Removed, was produced by Dave Michelinie, Bob Layton, and John Romita Jr. This one starts exactly where the last one left off, which is to say, Tony Stark getting beat up by the Enemen, who are doing the bidding of Count Nefaria, who wants to get Tony to give him help. And his daughter, Nefaria's daughter, Madame Mask, just doesn't want them to kill Tony. But he is more than just a helpless desk jockey, and manages to reach a hidden panel containing samples of his weapons. And he tries to fight back, but his shots go wide, and they quickly beat him. We get a little backstory on Nefaria, how his youth has been stolen, and that Mask and Stark can help reverse that process. The Enemen continue to attack Stark. With increasing severity, Tony realizes that he has to fight for his life at this point, and he opens his attaché case, revealing himself to be Iron Man as he dons the armor. It may mean so long secret identity, but that's better than hello death. Iron Man swiftly brings down the Enemen when suddenly a bomb goes off. Someone must have bombed the penthouse. But who? Why? And Whitney! The bomb had been placed by the Spymaster, who had appeared in a few brief interludes during the first half of the issue. That bomb was intended to kill Stark. Iron Man searches the wreckage for Madame Mask, but learns from the police that she's escaped. Iron Man traces her to Stark International and comes face to face with himself. Actually, it's his LMD double reprogrammed to serve Whitney. And I'm currently programmed to repel intruders. All intruders. And this is not the only time that an artificial intelligence created by Tony Stark has gone a little awry. Well, he manages to overload the LMD's circuits and finds Madame Mask trying to save Nefaria's life with Stark medical equipment. Whitney activates Stark's Jupiter landing vehicle to combat him, but he topples the immense vehicle over, accidentally smashing the equipment which contained Nefaria, killing him. Iron Man tries to explain to Whitney that it was an accident, but she, quite reasonable, is a wreck. I'll keep in touch, but right now I just need to be alone. I have a lot to sort out, and I have a feeling that might take a long, long time. The end. So two stories in a row where the love life of the main character doesn't go so well. Hopefully, Matt Murdock is not going to take Iron Man out drinking to drown their sorrows. Well, that certainly was a gut punch of an ending. And this issue was certainly not short on action either, despite having this emotional point to it. It was a very nice mix of action, character drama, and it moved fast. It was not a short read, I don't mean that, but it was an engaging, fast-paced story. Very good. And it did hit on one of those very common comic book tropes or traditions, and that is as soon as the Enemen, the team of villains, discovers our hero's secret identity, they're all killed. Yes, they were all killed by the Spymaster's bomb. And you've really got to think about that if you are a supervillain. Finding out a hero's secret identity may be the last thing you do. I really don't have a lot more to say about this story other than I really enjoyed it. The verdict on Marvel Superheroes Magazine, number 2. This was 96 pages of solid Marvel comics. Byrne, Miller and Jansen, Michelinie, Layton. And did I mention the 96 pages part? I mean, to be fair, it's about 80 pages of story. But still, that makes it a total quarter bin steal. I had not read any of these before, and I've really enjoyed these first two magazines, and I expect I'll really enjoy the next three magazines. But you'll have to wait till episodes 129, 139, and 149 to find out. And that wraps up my coverage of Marvel Superheroes Magazine, number 2, bringing episode 119 to a close. In episode 120, we'll be starting a new mini-series of summer episodes. And we'll be calling this mini-series Dial Q for Quarterbin. We'll be looking at Adventure 487 featuring, if it wasn't quite clear, Dial H for Hero. That's from DC Comics, cover dated November 1981. If you have any questions or comments about these issues, the episode, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!